Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, how are you doing today, my legal friend?
I'm very well, Mark. Just got back from China.
You did just get back from China, and you're going somewhere else next week, right?
That's right. I'm going to be in Kazakhstan next week.
Wow. And today you are in New York City.
Right. Good to be home. The activity for EB5 is really, I would say, on a scale between 1 to 5, it's like 7 right now.
Yeah. So you're in New York City, back at your firm. It's a 7 from 1 to 5. What are you doing right now?
There's this rush again going on for September 30th. As for any of our listeners who are not aware, of the very few of our listeners who may not be aware, but there is a sunset provision coming in on September 30th. It was extended from December of last year. And there's this mad flurry out there for people to file petitions, because a lot of people believe that on September 30th, the minimum amount will increase to 800 and to 1.2 million, and the source of funds is going to be more difficult.
Yeah, so there's a lot of uncertainty out there. People that have been on the fence for a while, they're basically saying, well, this last couple weeks here, this is the time to really get at it.
Right. Sometimes petitions do take time. People do suddenly wake up. what can I say? But anyway, we're very lucky today, Mark, to have on the show Peter Joseph from IIUSA. He's here to discuss the new legislation, which was just introduced only a week ago.
Well, Mona, you and I are certainly lucky to have him on the show, but allow me to introduce him to our listeners. Today, we have Peter D. Joseph joining us. Since 2010, Peter has served as the Executive Director of Invest in the USA. IIUSA is the National Trade Association for the EB-5 Regional Center Program. As listeners of the show may already know, this program accounts for billions of direct investment dollars into the United States annually and creates tens of thousands of U.S. jobs, as well as generates billions of tax dollars for the U.S. economy. Under his leadership, IIUSA has grown to represent a vast majority of capital flowing through the EB-5 program, while achieving advocacy, policy, and industry development goals by actively engaging in government and public affairs with an international reach. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Peter, again, welcome to the show. A week ago, everything stopped as Judiciary Chairman in the House, Bob Goodlatte, introduced a bill, right?
Absolutely. It was just a week ago today that we saw the introduction of what was eventually filed as H.R. 5992, which indeed was introduced by the Judiciary Chairman, Bob Goodlatte, as well as co-sponsored by the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, John Conyers of Michigan.
Peter, before we go into the bill, for a lot of our listeners are overseas and they really don't understand the way Congress works or the way, you know, our government works here. What usually happens when somebody introduces a bill? That doesn't mean to say it's law, of course.
Exactly right. When a bill is introduced, it has a long way to go from that moment to actually becoming law. And in this case, it would be looked at by the Judiciary Committee and have to go through a process there before being considered by just the House of Representatives. And that doesn't even get into the Senate side of the equation in U.S. Congress.
Right. Well, this is important because in China last week, a lot of people were talking and there was a lot of WeChat posts as if this was going to be the law. And I had to explain to a lot of people that, no, this is just an introduction. This is a proposal, rather, which has been introduced. And this is not going to be, well, hopefully, this is not going to be the final law.
Well, why is that? What does H.R. 5992 cover? Why is it that we don't want this to be the law?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mark. It's a 125-page piece of legislation that was just introduced last week. The EB-5 program is a multi-billion dollar industry that's relied upon all over the country for economic development projects and job creation. And therefore, it really needs the process that the U.S. Congress is designed to conduct to get good policy out of the political process. Reforming a multi-billion dollar industry like EB-5 really requires the input of stakeholders. And with the bill only being introduced at the end of last week, and really it was actually only introduced on Monday, a draft was available a week ago. That is a lot for experts and stakeholders to consider and to provide comment on. And that's exactly what needs to happen next. But any sort of rush on legislation is likely to have an outcome of unintended consequences that would have real economic harm and consequences to the United States.
Right. Peter, perhaps also we should just clarify to our listeners, because you were honored with this introduction from Mark. And I tell you, we have many people on our show who Mark doesn't introduce in the same way.
No.
But what is IIUSA's role? I mean, does Congress actually listen to IIUSA?
I appreciate that question. IIUSA is the Trade Association for the Regional Center Program. We're about 11 years old. Our offices are steps away from the Capitol building. I've had the pleasure of representing the EB-5 Regional Center industry in this capacity for almost 7 years now. I've really enjoyed being able to tell the story of EB-5 becoming such an important part of the U.S. economy. And so we have a lot to say about what different legislative proposals would do to ongoing economic activity that EB-5 is making possible. And that's what I spend most of my time on in interacting with Congress, is showing what activity is going on in a congressional district or a particular state, and then to make sure that those offices understand how different legislative proposals would affect those job-creating activities that are so important to them and their communities.
Thank you. That's a great explanation. So now I think we're ready to launch into a little bit about the bill. Obviously, a lot of people are they can only understand certain elements. There's a lot of technicalities in that bill, which the average investor, and even, to be frank, the average developer doesn't really understand, Peter. But that's the complexity which goes with EB-5, right?
Absolutely. We are a diverse set of stakeholders that come from different areas of the economy, whether it be financial services or maybe real estate development or project management, and then immigration. And when you put all these three together, I mean, you're really talking about financial services, immigration, and economic development. These are three groups of people who don't necessarily speak the same kind of professional language. And so it's really incumbent upon organizations like IIUSA to educate all of these different stakeholders to make sure that we all are kind of understanding these proposals in the same way, even if we're from different professional disciplines.
Right. Well, one of the big areas which had caused a lot of concern was the clause within the bill for retroactivity. And the retroactive date that was actually inserted was June of 2015.
Yeah, and I can't really think of a provision that has more potential economic harm tied to it than this retroactive application of new rules to economic development projects and investors that have already invested and have, from a project perspective, proceeded with the activity that is going to create the jobs that is the purpose of the program. And we're really concerned about that provision, and it really needs to be addressed as a priority, so that the activity that has already happened can continue to create American jobs at a time when our country, quite frankly, needs it.
Right. Well, Peter, the big thing is that I don't know if there's anyone on the Hill actually listening to this podcast, but most projects, I would say 98% of the projects, do not keep money in escrow after the I-526 is filed. So if somebody filed in June of 2015, there's a 99% chance that their money's already been deployed by the project. And if they're now required to come up with an additional 300 or 500,000, then, and they simply cannot do that, that would mean that the project would have to repay that money and that entire project could fail.
Mona, what you just described there sounds like the beginnings of what would result in a lot of litigation, both among investors and projects and the government. That's something that no stakeholder has interest in allowing to occur, especially when you think about what that would do to investors and their families, in addition to the economic development projects and the workers and other communities that are tied to the success of these projects going forward. So these provisions really need to be addressed and addressed as a priority.
Right. And I hasten to add to any of the listeners, this is not law yet. Hopefully it won't be law. And the other next provision, of course, which everybody is discussing, Peter, is the raising of the minimal amount, currently at 500,000, up to 800,000 and 1.2 for non-TEA areas. Now, this, I understand, is an area which really is not challenged so much.
You know, I think there's general agreement that since EB-5 has had the same minimum investment level since its inception, that it's an appropriate time to look at raising the minimum investment amounts generally. But how that is done and what the resulting amounts are really matter from two core perspectives. One is from the investor side, if it's too high a number and we end up not having a large enough investor pool that's able to make that kind of investment, we will have essentially shrunk the market in total capitalization of the EB-5 investor market, and that shouldn't be the policy goal of the United States. And the second piece is the differential between the non-TEA and TEA amount matters a lot. It should be enough that it makes an investor consider the differences in risk profiles between different projects, but not so much that it stops people from being able to use the non-TEA level to market quality projects that have a lower risk profile.
Interestingly, Peter, talking about shrinking the market, this is shown recently in the United Kingdom's investment program. When they raised it from 1 million to 2 million, suddenly there was less than half the amount of people filing these petitions.
That's such a good point, Mona, because EB-5 does not operate in a vacuum. There are examples around the world that we can learn from to make sure that the U.S. makes good policy in its immigrant investor program and remains competitive with the seemingly growing number of immigrant investor programs around the world that are all trying to attract the same new wealthy citizens of the world to their country to solve some of the economic challenges that we face here today.
That's absolutely correct, Peter. People tend to forget that, you know, we don't live in a vacuum. It's not just the United States. For example, this trip next week to Kyrgyzstan, I'm probably one of the only U.S. speakers, and there are many speakers from other countries like Cyprus, like Malta, like the UK, and other such countries. Australia being very popular today as well.
Can I ask a question real quick? How would this affect Chinese retrogression? I know right now that there's essentially a backlog of people that are investing from mainland China into the EB-5 program. Will this bill change any of that? And if the dollar amount raises, would that, you know, supply and demand, would that help offset a little bit?
It's a good question. I mean, generally speaking, this piece of legislation has some minor provisions that would help address some of the practical issues that have resulted from this backlog of applicants for EB-5 visas from China. But generally speaking, it doesn't have any of the really necessary fixes to add capacity to the annual visa allocation, which would really be the solution that's necessary for this program to maximize its economic impact, which we really feel strongly should be the underlying policy goal of the EB-5 program in the United States to serve its national interests. In terms of raising the minimum investment amount and maybe finding a new equilibrium within the market, I think it's really more important that we get more capacity no matter what the price point ends up being, so that the line, no matter what the minimum investment amount is, that the line for the obtaining a visa is competitive and reasonable so that investors can take advantage of what the program has to offer.
Right. And what we're talking about is this this cap. Well, it's a government imposed cap, but basically it's an artificial created supply system of 10,000 EB-5 visas, a quarter of which are the actual investors themselves. So about 2,500 people annually are investing at either currently the $500,000 rate or the $1 million rate. And I realize for regional centers, a lot of them are doing it in target employment areas. So they're going after, you know, the 500,000, which could be 800,000. So I realize that we're talking numbers all over the place, but it sounds like maybe what I'm hearing you say, or correct me, but what you would want is just moving the number, the minimum investment number from say $500,000 to say 800,000. What you would like to see is, well, perhaps make more visas available instead of 10,000 cap, make that higher, or am I hearing something different? Or is the actual bill different? I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Yeah. So unfortunately, the legislation does not do anything to add additional visa numbers to the annual allocation. And there are a few different ways to do that, all of which should be explored. You know, really, the principal investor should be the only one that counts towards the visa cap. there have been unused EB-5 and employment-based visas in the years past since the Immigration and Nationality Act in 1990, which, as a side note, was the last time that we did a real overhaul of our immigration system, which was quite a long time ago, so it's time to certainly revisit that. But addressing this cap by either recapturing or ensuring that only the investor is counted towards this annual allocation of EB-5 visas, these are the bigger issues that no matter what the price point ends up being in reform efforts, that there's a reasonable line that is predictable enough for reasonable people who are investing in the United States to make life plans. And, you know, that's the side of the equation for investors, and equally projects that have to manage the timelines and meeting the requirements of the EB-5 program, they also need this certainty so that they can manage their project and create the jobs, which again is, that's the whole point of this is that job creation activity. And it requires predictability in the system. And that's really what would be possible if we had more visas available.
Okay. So it sounds like what I'm hearing that's in HR 5992, which as Mona says, this isn't an official law yet. This is just a proposed bill. It doesn't sound like there's a lot of good news. It sounds like it's a couple of, negative things in there.
Well, actually, Mark, there are some good things in the bill. One of them being the fact that you can file concurrently. And what would that would mean is that somebody's in the United States, for example, they would be able to file for the adjustment, their green card petition, and get a work authorization whilst they're waiting for their 526 petition to be adjudicated.
Okay, so that way they would be able to work while they're waiting for the 10-month or
right,
however long it takes to process the 526. I guess that is a little bit of good news.
Well, but there's other things too. Perhaps, Peter, okay, you'd like to...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good example of one fix that is kind of around the edges of the capacity issues that we're facing within EB-5. And there are other smaller fixes like allowing for investors who have a approved A-2-9 before a visa number is available to enter the country as a unconditional permanent resident, assuming their I-829 was approved. So there are other smaller provisions that are addressing some of the resulting issues from capacity, but really this program requires changes on the fundamentals of capacity, how many visas are available and how quickly petitions can be adjudicated by the U.S. government.
Right. And the other thing that I would say, the other issue in the bill, which is good, are the integrity measures. A lot of the integrity measures there are long overdue. And I think once they are implemented, it will certainly give more credibility to the program.
Absolutely. And getting these provisions that address concerns related to either national security or anti-fraud and compliance provisions is a sign of a maturing industry that is ready for these kinds of requirements to really raise the bar of professional conduct within the industry. And that's something that we all at IIUSA and with other industry stakeholder partners are really focused on as a means of addressing some of these issues on program integrity that will allow for a really exciting next chapter of opportunity within EB-5.
Right. And Peter, a lot of investors are worried about some of the changes to source of funds. One being that it would no longer be, an investor would no longer be able to accept a gift from maybe an uncle or an aunt, only a parent or a sibling, and that loans in general would be scrutinized in a very different manner. Would IIUSA be looking at pointers like that as well as some of the bigger issues that we've been discussing?
Yeah, thank you, Mona. That's a great question because these issues really do matter, especially in the bigger picture. If we'll take a second to remind ourselves that we're living in a world where, you know, how money moves around matters more. You know, there's more international order to how these things happen. And, you know, we want EB-5 to be in line with those international standards. That said, having additional provisions within a piece of legislation that goes far, far further in requirements than the international financial services sector really imposes upon itself seems, again, counterproductive to the idea that the core goal of this program should be to maximize the economic impact of EB-5 for the United States of America. And countries around the world who have only recently really modernized and industrialized and perhaps had record-keeping systems that are not as standardized as what we've been used to in the United States, there's no reason why we should, as long as we can meet these international standards, so we know where the money's coming from, why we should require anything more. And it's important that we seek to amend any sort of proposal to simply adhere to these international standards rather than creating new hurdles for capital to get to the United States.
Yeah, I totally agree. Peter, last time around the block, a year ago, there was considerable discord between the various groups, the pressure groups, the lobbying groups for EB-5. Now, I know IIUSA is one of the largest. What's it like this time? Are we more united?
Absolutely. It's been a kind of a fun process. And Mona, I know you and I have had the opportunity to work together quite a bit this year. And just to take a step back, you know, IIUSA, we really dug in deep at the beginning of this year on policy issues and working with a variety of stakeholder groups that have really come out to support EB-5. And that's a really important and good development to have a lot of different interest groups care so much about this program. Thankfully, because of that process and really a patience in getting results, we have been lockstep with other industry stakeholder groups, including U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Real Estate Roundtable, EB-5 Investment Coalition, American Immigration Lawyers Association, and quite a few more, to demonstrate to Congress that this is an industry that has matured and therefore requires the same prudent process for making good policy that any other multi-billion dollar industry gets in the U.S. And I think our message has been effective in the halls of Congress to slow down the process so we can get this right.
Yeah, agreed. Peter, the big question, the question on everybody's lips, will anything happen on September 30th, or are we looking at a continuing resolution?
So right now, all signs point to a continuing resolution that starts in the Senate, likely sometime next week. That includes a reauthorization with no changes to the EB-5 Regional Center Program, likely through December 9th or around there. And the House will, in all likelihood, take up that same reauthorization through that same date in the following week. So continuing resolution in the short term, that will set up a very important date in mid-December. As far as I know, there's an election or something that's supposed to happen between now and then.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, it seems to be following me around in the news. Depending on how that goes will really dictate what is possible in a lame duck session. And it's important between now and then for industry stakeholders to really educate their members of Congress about what is going on in their district that EB-5 is responsible for, so that they're ready in December to understand that there's real economic activity and real American jobs on the line here. And so we got to get this right.
So it sounds like there's probably no real risk in the next 2 weeks because there may be some type of continued resolution. But instead of really a 2-week time period, now we're looking at a 3-month time period. As you mentioned, there's an election in there. But Peter, let me ask you, what could someone do, whether they're a regional center, a developer, or an EB-5 investor? What can they do to help, or what can they do to stay abreast of these changes that may occur in mid-December?
Sure. So to get engaged with members of Congress, one, we'd be happy to hear from you at IIUSA. You can visit us on the web at iiusa.org. We have a really wide variety of resources to inform you, to empower you as an advocate, to make sure that you have good information to deliver to representatives in Congress. And they'll all be home in district and state after they finish passing a funding package here in Washington, D.C., and it's a great opportunity for developers and regional centers to invite these members to project sites and photo ops and all the things that demonstrate just how important this program is and connect those dots with federal representatives.
It makes sense. Again, I'm laughing, but these are honestly projects that create, you know, jobs now and tax dollars in the foreseeable future. So it does make sense.
Peter, look, the last bill was introduced by Senators Leahy and Grassley, and this time this bill's been introduced by Bob Goodlatte. Have you met all of these senators and congressmen, and how do you interact with, or how does IIUSA interact with members of Congress?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had several meetings over the course of the year and in the last just week with the ranking members and chairs of Judiciary Committee in both the Senate and House. It's really important as a national trade association for us to, one, maintain those essential relationships with our Committee of Authorization, Judiciary Committee, but then also to make sure that the rest of Congress is appropriately informed, and especially congressional leadership, the appropriations committees on both sides of Congress, where the CR will have to originate from, and EB-5, as a historical matter, has tended to be reauthorized on appropriations packages, so it's imperative that those committees understand this program and how it's affecting their states and districts. And then, of course, the Homeland Security and Intergovernmental Affairs Committee, which has oversight responsibility with the Department of Homeland Security that administers EB-5. And so that brings me to the last point, which is, you know, in addition to the tireless work we do with advocating with Congress, we also make sure that we have good communication channels with the seemingly never-ending list of federal agencies that are needed to protect the integrity of the program and to make sure that it's being administered in an appropriate way. And so whether it's the Department of Homeland Security and USCIS or the Department of Commerce, who should be producing a EB-5 economic impact report in the coming month or so, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and so on, all of these different agencies have a role to play. IIUSA is the industry representative that we want to hear from you so that your perspective can be plugged into those communication channels that we've spent years developing.
And the good thing is, Peter, that the average immigration attorney or developer or even just an interested person who's thinking of investing, they can reach out to you and they can reach out to any one of us, members of the Public Policy Committee and so on, and give their opinion, and you do listen.
Absolutely. It's an essential piece of our policy deliberation process, of our advocacy process. We need to hear from stakeholders, and it's the only way we're going to get a prudent piece of legislation is by speaking up as a group.
I agree. Well, thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure we're going to have you back again.
I look forward to it.
Agreed. Peter, thank you so much for coming on. And again, thank you for all your work and advocacy and, you know, ensuring some predictability and continued economic growth with the EB-5 program. Thank you.
Well, thank you too, Mark.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.